here's a guy who's just in the nick of time. What does that make us?
Big damn heroes, sir.
Ain't we just?
This is a horrible, horrible game which I love and I adore.
Hello and welcome to Shoot the Breeze on Resonance 104.4 FM, a film and TV radio show where a handful of film enthusiasts shoot the breeze about all things film and television. I'm Marcus E. Acko, and this is the second type of this episode of the show where we are focusing primarily on our guest. We had one with Jamal Edwards a few weeks ago, and now we have a new guest who's in the studio with us. He is a designer and he's a costume designer for the Crystal Maze, as well as the director and founder of Simon Carter Limited. You've recognized the websites, you recognize the clothing shops, but enough about me talking about him. Let's get him to introduce himself with the first question. Please tell us who you are and which first costume character grabbed your attention.
Well, first of all, thanks very much for having me on, Marcus. It's an absolute delight to be here today. So I thought long and hard about this and sort of scratched the dusty recesses of my memory.
Okay.
And this might be a little bit of a surprise, and it's going to appeal to people of a certain age.
But don't start it that way, because you're going to make yourself sound like you're dating.
Exactly.
For those of you who've never seen him before, he's going to make himself sound aged. He's not. He's a very
young. I'm only 32.
Exactly. He looks 31. Sorry.
Stop it.
I interrupted you. You go for it.
So it was Zebedee on the Magic Roundabout.
Oh, okay. That was the first costume character that grabbed your attention.
Yeah, because I just wanted that yellow jacket.
Fair enough. I didn't grow up with Zebedee. I grew up in Nigeria. We didn't get Magic Roundabout. I heard about it when I was growing up as a teenager over here in the UK. So I'd heard a lot about Magic Roundabout, but I've never actually watched an episode of Magic Roundabout.
It was good stuff. Okay, I mean, it was widely supposed to be sort of a pretty much a parody of kind of the psychedelic drugs culture at the time, wasn't it,
yeah.
I think. But when you're four or three or two, whatever it was, you know, that kind of passes you by.
Yeah.
And it's just the yellow jacket that's in the mind.
True. You get the flashing colours and everything else.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so you think that influenced any of your work?
No, I don't think it probably did. I just think it's interesting looking back that made a kind of hole for itself in my memory. And I think, you know, perhaps that says that obviously I was aware of kind of clothing mm-hmm. and outfits and style at a fairly early age. It was not long after that I nagged my parents ceaselessly and endlessly and interrupted with tantrums to get me a tie. I wanted to wear a tie.
Oh,
there's a picture of me aged about four and a half or five
wearing a tie.
Yeah.
All right. Which is funny because you're not wearing a tie right now. I mean, did you sort of grow out of the phase of wearing ties, or I mean, as a designer, did you feel no? Actually, there's a time and a place for a tie.
Ooh, we could do a whole session on the tie, couldn't
okay.
we? Really, yeah.
I
think the tie itself is always going to have a place. You know,
okay.
I mean, it's with the rise of less formal dressing, with the rise of kind of. Well, the demise of the suit. I mean, when I began in tailoring suits were around 26% of the menswear market. They're now just under 6%.
Okay.
And ties alongside that, although tie sales have grown a little bit in recent years with people electing to wear them. You know, we don't have to wear a tie for most jobs now. You're not wearing a tie. You know, I'm not wearing a tie.
True.
I think the last time I wore a tie was probably to an awards ceremony. But there's a whole generation of people who don't have to wear a suit or mm-hmm. a tie. So then they choose to, perhaps, if they're going out and want to make a statement on a Saturday night.
Okay.
But it's a different kind of look to the sort of suits that maybe we grew up with when we had to wear one.
That makes sense. Now, you said you got the fashion bug from an early age. When I did my research, I discovered that you were on the way to becoming an immunologist.
Yes.
How do you go from being an immunologist to being a designer?
Oh, it's an easy thing to do. You know, you wake up one day and you think, I don't know, cutting up mice isn't really for me. It's context, really. it was a sort of choice for people that didn't get into medicine at the time, which I didn't. My parents thought medicine was a good idea.
Okay.
I was pretty unconvinced. If I wasn't doing this, I'd probably be an architect or a barrister.
Oh, okay.
Yep. But, yeah, we can come on to that one. Yeah. You didn't expect that.
I did.
But no, exactly.
Not the barrister part. I mean, yeah, actually, the barrister part did because of something you said off air, but the architect side of things, I guess that ties in with design.
Yeah. So they thought, no, those are risky careers. Why don't you go and be a doctor like a good boy?
Yeah.
So I tried, didn't get the grades, and ended up doing immunology, but it wasn't a load of fun. I mean, I qualified, I got my degree.
Yeah.
But I was studying on the King's Road in the 1980s, and that was a really very interesting time. And you couldn't avoid fashion. I mean, it was the birthplace of the New Romantics. Punk was just coming to an end. Mm. Vintage clothing was kind of big and serious for the first time in perhaps 20 or 30 years. So it was a great time to be young and a student and down in the King's Road for the first time. I was born up and brought up in Essex, in the sort of countryside bit of Essex. So this was all dazzling and bright lights.
And that was, I mean, the turning point where you decided, okay, you're going to move away from the safe path of being an immunologist into becoming a designer. I mean, what do you remember? What actually made you make that decision?
Very clearly. I had a part-time job one day a week in this very cool vintage clothing store on the King's Road, and I just realized this was absolutely what I wanted to do.
Okay,
you know, it was about meeting people, it was about buying and selling, it was about clothing, it was about style, it was about very, very interesting customers at the time. And I just really connected with that and thought, this is definitely what I want to do. And I'd had a little business on the side. I would buy vintage clothing from jumble sales around Chelsea and then sell it to this shop. And I made enough money to buy my first classic car.
Okay.
I had a little taste for business as well.
So from what I gathered, you're buying other people's work and putting them together and then selling them on. When did you actually decide to start designing your own?
Well, there's a connection to that part of it as well, because people used to bring in a lot of products and sell it. And one day somebody brought in a 1930s motorcyclist brooch.
Okay.
And I've always had a love of old British bikes and cars. Mm. So the guys that ran the store said, look, why don't you take that today instead of your wages? So I wore this little brooch and everybody said, wow, that's such a cool design. So
you got given a brooch instead of wages?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was a thing. Oh. It was the 80s.
Okay.
Guys wore brooches. Am I sounding defensive?
No. Just fair enough. Okay.
No, it was, and everybody loved it. Everybody said, where did you get that? Where did you get that? So I thought, well, if everybody loves this, why don't I get some made and try and sell them?
Sure.
And that's how I started my business.
Okay.
So I started at the top of the King's Road, walked all the way down to the bottom of the King's Road. I had 100 of these things made in pewter from a factory in Cornwall. Yeah. Knocked on every door, went into every little menswear store, and there were loads of them then.
Yeah.
And nobody bought them.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was all starting to look a little bit tragic. And everyone was going to get one for Christmas for the next 10 years.
Being an immunologist kind of seemed like a tempting
Suddenly,
idea, didn't it?
I thought, wow, I love immunology. And then there was this very, very high-end jewellers at the bottom of Sloane Street called Cobra and Bellamy. They're not there anymore, but they were very legendary. Very grand, too, and quite intimidating. And it was pouring with rain, but I thought, I've got nothing to lose. So I went and I said, do you want to buy some of my little brooches? And they picked them up and sort of picked over them. And I thought, no, this is going to be a bit dismissive. And they said, yeah, sure, we'll take 50.
Oh, okay.
So then the next door was so much easier because I said, well, Cobra and Bellamy just bought these. Mm. And someone said, oh, cool, I'll take some.
Ah, and it started from there. So it just started from there. So my next question was going to be, what's the first design that you were most proud of? Is that the one that you were going to go with?
I think it's obviously the most important. I mean, everybody's career has a turning point, doesn't it? Everyone has a pivot where they're given a junction, and it's which way you go at the junction. And that was the junction for me.
Okay.
I think it's probably not my favorite design. I was kind of pondering over this one. And I think my favorite design is a cufflink that I designed to take an aspirin. And it has, the cover of it is like an aspirin out of chrome-plated brass. It says aspirin on it. And you unscrew it and you can store a little aspirin inside it.
Okay.
And I invented that about 15 or 16 years ago now. It's still in my collection.
Okay.
And probably it's my biggest selling, longest lived cufflink that I've ever designed.
Oh, okay.
I sometimes think that when I die, they'll make a kind of aspirin cufflink shaped tombstone for me. Not sure. Could be a good thing.
At least the tombstone, not the coffin itself.
Yeah. Now, that's a very good point. I'm going to insist, actually, get this right, is the tombstone.
Is the tombstone.
Yeah. Or maybe if it really goes well, a mausoleum.
Okay. And you mentioned the fact you went into cufflinks. You've been described as being the king of cufflinks. Mm. And you've brought two pairs of cufflinks in preparation for my next question,
yes.
Which was, so what can you tell about a man by the cufflinks he wears?
Yeah, well, I think it's about detail, isn't it? And sometimes in detail, we give away a lot about our personality. In the same way that shoes are a kind of good indicator of a person.
Mm-hmm. Now I'm feeling very self-conscious with the
shoes.
That's
okay. I'm not looking down, Marcus. Okay. I'm not looking down. I'm focusing on the cufflinks.
Yeah, sure. I'm barefoot.
Cufflinks, they're still an important part of my business, but generally speaking, people aren't wearing cufflinks as much as they were, say, 10 years ago. And there was a time, kind of 10 or 12 years ago, when it was a big look, and you had it kind of promoted by really big style icons like David Beckham. Mm-hmm. So all the young men were wearing big knotted ties and formal shirts and double cuff shirts with cufflinks. And we sold hundreds of thousands of pairs every year. So I would be on the tube and sort of looking at people's cuffs and thinking, is that one of my designs? Oh, is that one of mine? No, it's not you, so-and-so. And I thought, it's a good job I don't make zips for a living.
Yeah, because you'll obsess constantly.
Well, you'd be looking in the wrong place, wouldn't you, then?
So with that in mind, I mean, if when you're watching a television show, do you do the same thing? Do you analyze what a character is wearing based on either the cufflinks that you see them wearing, like James Bond, for example? You tend to look at watch a James Bond movie and analyze what type of cufflinks he's wearing, or think maybe I could have designed a better one for him?
I think with the case of James Bond, there wasn't really an awful lot of choice on the market mm-hmm. at the time that most of the Bond films were done. And when he's wearing black tie, which is usually when he's wearing cufflinks, it's very traditional.
Sure.
It's very, very safe. It's a kind of very classic pair of plain silver or plain gold cufflinks. Mm-hmm. So the two that I brought in are, if you like, from the opposite ends of the spectrum, really, aren't they?
Please describe them for the audience.
I will do. It's a little bit of a visual thing for radio, but here we go. So on the left, we've got a pair of just plain metal cubes, and they're a rhodium plate, so make them very hard wearing. But they're small. They're about 6 mil square, and they're rhodium cubes. And they're very classic, and they're very easy to wear. They're very universal. And on the other end of the spectrum, we've got a pair of frog cufflinks, and they're little frogs made out of malachite with little Swarovski crystal eyes. And the body of the frog itself is, again, a platinum plate over brass. And that's a much more expressive, a much more characterful, a much more sort of personality-led purchase.
So can I wear those to a wedding?
Of course you can wear those to a wedding.
Fair enough. Yeah. I'm
asking.
You should
never be scared of cufflinks, Marcus.
They as soon as I saw them, they grabbed my attention first. The cube ones, I looked at them and I thought, no, those look classy. They you know, I would definitely wear that to an award ceremony or a wedding. The frog ones I'd wear, you know, I looked at that and thought, there's a part of me that wants to wear that, and I'm not repulsed by them. I'm not pushed away from them.
That's a good advertising slogan, isn't it? Simon Carter cufflinks, they're not repulsive.
They're not repulsive. Yeah, yeah. You put that as a slogan.
But I think we've made it, actually.
You need to put me on royalties for
I
when
think
you,
we
when
do.
You're doing that.
Yeah.
Excellent. You listen to Shoot the Breeze on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Marcus Iacco, and in the studio with me, we have the designer of some amazing cufflinks, as well as costume design for Crystal Maze, which we'll come to in a second, but also the founder of the very successful Simon Carter Limited shops that you find everywhere. It's Simon Carter. I was reading an interview, and we spoke about this earlier, where the interviewer was with you in one of your stores, I believe in London Mayfair.
Yes.
And you stopped the interview because a customer had come in and you walked away to go and serve the customer in the middle of your interview.
Yes.
You own the company.
Yes.
The company, it's a world-renowned company. You have stores, have you opened recently in Asia?
I've got 5 stores in India. Yeah,
in India.
My latest. Yeah.
Okay. Yet you will actually you step away from an interview to go and help a customer. Tell me about that particular. Tell me about your process with that, because I make these kind of jokes saying that if I were in your position, I'd basically just sit back and watch Netflix all day, and hire people to do that job for me. But you think differently.
Yes, but I don't specifically rotate myself into the stores.
But are you sure about that?
Yeah, I'm actually sure about
that.
Yeah. But if I'm there and the customer needs helping, and maybe another member of staff is busy, of course I'm going to jump in. And
you do some amazing work with your design. Can you talk us through your process in terms of how you get inspired with designs?
Sure. That's a question I get asked a lot, and it's really difficult not to lapse into the kind of trite or the cliched, really, because I suppose I've got quite an inquiring mind.
Okay.
So I will pick up things from all around. So, for instance, I was in Mumbai in September for a store opening there. And I got chatting with some of my Indian crew, and they talked about Indian matchbox covers and the fact that India has this amazing history of doing really beautiful, interesting matchbox covers. Mm-hmm. So I tracked some images down, and sure enough, they are amazing. So I've done a shirt that's just got a repeat pattern of about 20 or 30 different Indian matchbox covers.
Okay.
So it can simply come out of a conversation. It can be a detail, architectural detail that I notice. It could be one of my passions. I play croquet, and this season we've done a series of vintage croquet players. Mm-hmm. So it comes from all around. I think it comes from having open eyes and an open mind.
Okay. So do you settle down, and how long does it take you to come up with a design? Do you tend to, and I'm not saying you have a fixed time saying, you know, I've got an hour, I'm going to get a design or whatnot, but on average, how long does it take you to come up with a design that you're proud of to send to market?
That is such a really difficult question because it varies. I think if you've got to labor at a design, mm-hmm. I think you're in trouble. I think it needs to come fairly quickly and fairly spontaneously. One of the cufflinks that's been a very good, successful design over the years is an acorn. And that came out of visiting a National Trust property, getting back in the car and finding I'd got an acorn trapped in my sock for some reason. And thinking, ooh, if we did this out of tiger's eye and we did the metal part and la 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 and decorated it, could we do it? And that's been a great seller. So that was almost immediate. It was kind of instant.
Okay.
And I think from trapped acorn in sock to in store was about 3 months, which is pretty quick. Yeah, very quick.
Okay.
With tailoring, you're working at least 12 months out, sometimes 18 months out.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a pretty long gestation period.
Okay. No, that makes perfect sense. The reason why I wanted to ask that question in particular was because you hear about other designers who, you said you don't want to labor the point on actually picking a particular design and working on it, but you hear other designers spend days, weeks, just, you know, trying to get it absolutely perfect, what they conceive as being perfect, and then they roll that out. That kind of leads me to my next question. What do you feel sets you apart from other designers?
There's three aspects to any Simon Carter product, and I don't think they are unique to me, but I think I do them very well. The first is originality of design.
Okay.
So whether it is something like a pair of shoes or through to a jacket or a shirt or a pair of cufflinks or a watch, it's original.
Mm.
It's exclusive to Simon Carter. The second is quality. Mm. We pack that product with quality. Beautiful fabrics, beautiful materials, the most that we can afford to do. And then the third thing is that I think we offer really great value for money. We oftentimes use fabrics in our jackets and our shirts, which you can find in other designers or brand names, and they're always 2, 3, 4 times the price. But they've chosen to spend an awful lot more on their marketing budgets.
Okay.
I've always let the product be my marketing. So we do keep the prices a little more affordable. I know you're thinking £135 for a shirt. It's still a lot of money.
That says more about me than it does about. I'm sure
I accept the fact that it does sound like quite a lot of money. But when you look at the quality, also they're very small runs.
Okay.
We're often working with mills like Liberty of London,
mm-hmm.
and we've now got to the stage where Liberty will let us reproduce a design from their archive exclusively, which is amazing. It's a wonderful thing to do. Mm-hmm. But that quality of beautiful, fine tarn along fabric does not come cheap. Trust me.
No, I can imagine. Like I said, I looked through your website, saw some of the shirts, especially some of the watches that were on there were very good. I was drawn to them. Like I said, it was just money side of things, but that's mainly me. I tend not to spend too much on fashion. I spend all my money on films and television and everything else. If I can go and buy, if I can subscribe to a Netflix account or anything like that, I would literally be doing that.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you could just take my paycheck and pay it directly to them. But I do want to learn more about fashion as well, because I want to know what goes with sort of what shirts, what jackets go with, what shoes, cufflinks, talked about the cufflinks as well. And you mentioned the ties earlier. And you said how ties are sort of going out of fashion. Now, is there a likelihood that something like ties would come back? Or what brings something like ties back into fashion? What causes that rotation of fashion tastes?
I do believe that most fashion trends are pretty cyclical.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I wouldn't necessarily call ties out of fashion, because I think that there are people who really, really enjoy wearing ties.
Mm-hmm.
And for them, it's part of their style. And you are starting to see a little bit more of a dressed-up look with TV presenters. I always say, watch what the Match of the Day reporters wear.
Oh, okay.
They're a kind of barometer for public taste. And they've gone from being very well-dressed and very suited and booted through to extremely casual And now they're starting to come back very suited and booted again. Yeah. But it's a slimmer look. It's a very flattering suit. It's much more of a kind of elective purchase suit. It's much more of a kind of Saturday night out suit. And I think that's where the difference is going.
I can assure you, I never expected to be told that I should look to Gary Lineker for fashion tips.
I didn't specifically say him.
Alan Shearer?
As a kind of general rule. But it's true. And I think everything is cyclical. But although one of the issues that menswear has, and of course everyone's reading about the problems with House of Fraser and the high street generally, is that in men's fashion, we haven't really had any major trends or any major changes or movements really for about 25 years. Mm-hmm. And I would challenge your listeners. I would say when you're on the tube next, have a look around you in the carriage. Try and guess what decade most of the men bought their clothing.
All right.
You know, I was lucky enough to grow up through the 70s and 80s, and goodness me, you couldn't wear anything in 1984 that you bought in 1980. I mean, you'd be laughed at a court.
Okay.
But, you know, we've all got clothing, we men, we've all got clothing that is probably 10, 15, 18 years old, and it's still perfectly acceptable to wear.
Does it also, is there also the impact of where in particular you look? For example, you talk about the tube, but if I get off the tube at Covent Garden, for example, that would be completely different than if I got off just throwing a random place out there, Balham. I may see the trend of what men are wearing in Balham completely different from Covent Garden, Soho, Camden, etc. Does that also play a part in the dress sense?
A little bit. Fashion sense? Yeah, London is like every city, it is tribal, and all the tribes wear something slightly different. But I don't think it's fundamentally different. I mean, the challenge I always say to people is, if you were to have a fancy dress party and you said 70s, great. Everybody knows what to do. You know,
sure.
Loads of different stuff for 70s or 60s even. 80s, yep, you know, punk power dressing at the end of the 80s.
Shoulder pads,
you got it. Or new romantics. There's, you know, three or four really great looks just within the 80s. 90s starting to get a little bit harder. And what about the noughties? I mean, you know, what about this decade? You know, really, it's tough. You know, somebody said the other day, after scratching their head, they said to me, cargo pants. I thought, is that the best that the noughties gave us? You know, it's kind of slim pickings. And I think that's one of the reasons that people really like my shirts. They are a little bit of a Marmite decision. You either really love them or really don't.
Okay.
But they are different. And at a time when a lot of fashion is very bland and very, very safe, what I do with my shirts and also my jackets, but principally my shirts, is very different.
Okay, so I mean, with your jackets, what is your main pull for a jacket? What's your design? What inspires you to design a jacket?
What I like about my jackets, and what I think is really important, is versatility.
Okay.
Because we are at a time when money is tight. I'm asking people perhaps to spend upwards of £400 on a Simon Carter jacket. The last thing I want is for them thinking to themselves, I can only wear it to X.
To church.
So I really want everything to be as versatile and long-lived as possible.
Okay.
So, and here's an interesting distinction. I've always been very clear that there is an important difference between fashion and style. And what I do, I don't know whether it is or isn't fashionable. Mm-hmm. I don't particularly care for fashion. I'm very interested in style.
Okay.
And what I do has a certain style.
So, okay. But you are in a position where you could influence, or do you feel you're in a position where you could influence what the fashion trend should be?
That's a good question, because if I send enough people out in my shirts because I think they're stylish, does that become a fashion trend? I guess that's your point.
Yeah.
Possibly. Yes, it does. But I think the starting point is that style is what you make it, and fashion is what you follow.
Mm-hmm.
Doing strongly patterned shirts is, although I think we really kind of own that niche at that level, it's not unique to me. I mean, there's plenty of other people on the high street that do that to a lesser or greater extent. So, but I remember years and years ago, it's so random, as a child, my French teacher on the blackboard suddenly wrote, "Style is what you make it," and that just remained with me. I thought, it's a bit odd for a French lesson. But what a great way of looking at life. And style does live on forever.
Yeah.
And it is unique to oneself. You know, you've got a particular style. It's your style. That's how you dress. That's how you're comfortable. You know, that's Marcus's style.
Mm-hmm. It's on high street store at night. My style is just basically I pick up different things, and when I feel comfortable in, I wear it.
There you go. But you end up with a style, you see. You end up with a personal style.
I have been putting myself down in terms of my fashion sense, but I think I am quite fashionable. people close to me don't, they disagree, but yeah. you should see his face. His face was like, really? That's
no,
fashionable?
I just had my querulous face on. That's a good word for the day.
I'm just going to put a rug over me
now. It's a very nice jacket, Marcus.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We just need to get you in a Simon Cowell shirt.
You know what? That's fine. I've got a t-shirt on. We'll talk about that afterwards. Okay. You're listening to Shoot the Breeze on Resonance 104.4 FM. I am Marcus E. Acko, getting fashion tips and style tips from the great Simon Carter. You were talking about Crystal Maze. Hmm. Tell us about Crystal Maze, how you got into designing the costumes for
it. Sure. Well, Richard Ayoade is a Simon Carter fan. He's been a great ambassador for me for a few years. He used to live in southeast London near Crystal Palace, where I have a branch. Mm-hmm. And he would just pop in and buy shirts. And so we got to know each other through that. So when he got the Crystal Maze gig, he just approached me and said, would I design the costumes for it? And immediately I said yes, because I just knew this would be great fun. And it was. It was terrific fun, and coming up with a look that was very right for Richard, but also would really work on stage. Mm-hmm. But also felt that it had a kind of reference or a kind of relevance to where Crystal Maze had been. And the production company were very happy with it, and Richard was very delighted with it. So they said to me, would I like to have a go at redesigning the contestants' jumpsuits? And
yeah.
I said, absolutely. And that was fun too. And my starting point for that was, I mentioned earlier, that I always loved old cars. And I love those pictures of those Le Mans races in the 1950s. When they're running to their cars at the start in these amazing jumpsuits, oftentimes wearing a tie. I mean, the idea of like Lewis Hamilton doing F1 in a tie. But these chaps, these gentlemen racers.
It's aerodynamic.
they've been tested for drag efficiency.
Yep.
And I thought that's a good starting point because it's active. I wanted something a little bit retro. So I worked with a UK manufacturer, actually, of racing jumpsuits. Mm-hmm. And we tweaked around a little bit. We obviously had to get the Maze logos on and they had to be color-coded. But that's worked really well, too. And we're carrying on that collaboration. They just finished filming Series 2. So that's been really good fun to do.
So do you get much in the way of creative freedom? If you were to think, actually, now I want to do something completely different with next season's jumpsuits and maybe, or not even necessarily their jumpsuits, work with Richard Ayoade. So do they allow you enough creative
freedom,
thank you, to just jump in and say, you know what, today I'm going to make him wear something completely out of the norm, something different and stylish, to a different style?
Not really, insofar as the project was quite led by Richard. Mm-hmm. He's somebody who knows what works for him.
Okay.
I think it's important for anybody who's in the public domain, and you, I'm sure, would agree that you've got to feel comfortable in what you're wearing.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, it just puts you ill at ease. It's a look that really is very him. They're corduroy suits. Mm-hmm. We use an English mill, so basically it's an English fabric, an English make. And we wanted something that was a little bit like an upscale geography teacher.
Okay.
Mad geography teacher. So he's teamed that up with my pattern shirts. Mm-hmm. And he's obviously a very creative individual, and he really enjoys the process of working on this. So we had, for instance, some designs on shirts that we weren't sure we were going to do, or we were going to hold them back for another season. And Richard saw them and asked if he could incorporate them in his wardrobe. Mm-hmm. There's obviously certain minimums you have to do to produce a shirt. So we said, yes, of course, if that's what you want to do. So we've now got those coming into our stores, and we reference them as the Crystal Maze range.
Nice, okay.
So that's fun. So he's a pleasure to work with. But I think it's a look. And so for season two, we just changed the colours around. But basically, the look remains. Because if you think of Richard O'Brien, he just had that look.
Yes,
and
he didn't
really change that. He made that his hallmark.
So did that give you sort of the bug to design for other TV shows or even maybe move into the film industry?
I'm waiting for the phone calls.
Okay.
Yeah, put it that way.
Yeah, so what would be your ideal film character? We're going to come into more about films, but what would be your ideal character if you were to get given, if the president of Hollywood were to come in and say, right, Simon, I want you to design, to pick any character in any film or TV show that we have available, and it's going to be you designing what they wear. Who would you go for, and what would you do?
That's a really tough one, isn't it? Because I'm attracted to some of the very classic stars that are obviously long dead, the Cary Grants of this world.
Yeah.
Because again, we talk about style and fashion, and actually people like Cary Grant managed to combine both, because mm-hmm. he carried what was probably quite fashionable, mm-hmm. but with a huge degree of personal style.
Sure.
So I'd love to go back in time, perhaps, and, and work with some of those
the guys. President of Hollywood has the power to send you back
machine?
In time.
Okay, absolutely, then I'm going back in time. I'd love to do North by Northwest and have a go at kind of referencing that and making it sort of
up-to-date.
That's
a good pull. Okay, North by Northwest, Cary Grant. Okay, no, that's... Okay.
But maybe if they said, okay, we've managed to find someone that is as charismatic and screenful as him, we're going to do an updated version of it. Were you interested? I'd say absolutely really want to get stuck in.
But would you keep the same sort of style or would you then influence it with your own taste?
I'd like to mix it up a little bit. I'd like to put, because I do love vintage clothing.
Sure.
I'm really attracted to the quality and styles and the fact that everything we wear today has got a past, really. Mm-hmm. Whether you go back to Beau Brummel, essentially, for what we're wearing today. So I think I'd mix it up, and I know we're going to talk about film, but I was thinking on the way over here about different films that have sort of mixed this up in a way that Gattaca did.
Yes.
And you get that sort of, I can't quite place this. Is mm-hmm. it 60s, 50s, futuristic?
Yep, yep.
And I think sometimes costume works best when you can't quite place it. There's a degree of familiarity mixed with an uncertainty around it.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. The technology would place it in the future, but then the costume and the fashion would bring it right back down to...
Yeah, I always think those make for very interesting filmic moments.
Okay. Now, we've been talking a lot about your clothes fashion, your sort of your clothes design and cufflinks and everything to do with clothes. Do you design anything else? Not necessarily shoes. Sets?
No, furniture? I've pretty much stuck to... I'm a great believer in doing what you do as best as you possibly can before you move on. And one of the questions, for instance, I get asked a lot is, why don't I do women's clothes?
Okay.
Yeah, and that's a very good question. The answer is, even having done this for 33 years, I still don't think I've done it 100%. I think there'll always be more to do. I also think one of the reasons I'm still here after 33 years is because I haven't gone and done a whole load of things and maybe not got them quite right.
Sure.
I've just stuck to what I know. Mm-hmm. And I've been lucky enough to have very good people help me on that journey. I think one of the things about keeping going this long is knowing the bits you're really good at doing and recognizing some of the bits you need some help with and getting people in to do that and not being too proud. So I haven't done anything like that. That's not to say it doesn't interest me, because it would fantastically, but it is one thing at a time. I only launched my own shoe range last year. So it is one thing at a time with me.
So you talk about bringing in people in to come and help you out. Mm. Do you have plans? And I think I read somewhere, but I need to verify it with yourself. Do you plan on mentoring other young designers to sort of follow in your footsteps? Or
I do that. I mentor a couple of people quite long term. I've just recently stepped down as a non-exec on a swimwear brand, having helped them from sort of concept over a drink in a pub through to third round finance raising. There's a young London-based designer that I help with, actually fantastic guy with really interesting wallets and leather goods. Mm-hmm. So I mentor him.
Okay.
And I'm also a non-exec on United Kingdom Fashion and Textiles, UKFT, which is our trade body. So I do a lot of sort of ad hoc, sort of what they call it, speed mentoring and things like that with them. So I suppose I'm at the age of my career or stage of my career where you start putting things back after all these years.
Yeah, you're paying it forward, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I do like doing that. It's just limits, obviously, to how much time I can devote to it. But I get as much out of it as they do. I love the energy and excitement and the way of looking at things differently that comes with doing that.
So, and I asked this question the last time with someone else. Let's say there's a schism in the universe right now, and you find yourself talking on this show when the show goes out to the 5-6-year-old version of yourself that has that inspiration after watching Magic Roundabout and saying, "Ooh, that yellow jacket looks amazing. I may want to become a designer." What sort of advice would you give to that 5-year-old version of yourself?
Just do it. Just do it. I get asked this a lot. People come to me with dreams, business plans, outlines, concepts, whatever you want to call it. It's extremely rare for me to say don't, because I think that the biggest risk in life is not trying. I think it is, particularly if you're young, just give it a go. What's the worst that'll happen? It won't work out. That's the worst that'll happen. Okay, nobody's died. Mm-hmm. You might have lost some money. You know, you might have to pick yourself up and dust yourself down. But trust me, that isn't as bad as getting to, I don't know, 67 years old and not having done it and look back and thinking, damn it, I wish I'd tried.
So the regret is worse than actually trying and failing.
Absolutely. It's got to be, isn't it? It's got to be. We're here for such a short space of time.
It's my, it's my philosophy. I do agree with that. You're listening to Shoot the Breeze on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Marcus E. Acko, and we have a special episode today of Shoot the Breeze where we're talking with Simon Carter, who's the designer and the founder of Simon Carter Limited. There are stores across London. I mean, we've talked about the Mayfair store. You talked about one in Crystal Palace. Where else could someone get your goods from?
Sure. Well, we've obviously got a website where all the shirts and the cufflinks and all the goodies are on, which is simoncarter.net. We have 12 concessions in House of Fraser stores, mm-hmm. so the biggest House of Fraser stores. And then I have stores of my own in Brighton, Crystal Palace, which you mentioned, Mayfair, Blackheath, yes. and then Lamb's Conduit Street in Bloomsbury.
Okay.
So a little bit random. The one thing that ties them all together is they're all in old buildings. I've got a soft spot for old buildings.
Is that a design thing as well?
You're not the first person to ask that. I think inadvertently it is. Okay. Yes, I think it's about personality in the brand.
Sure.
I've never thought of Simon Carter as a shopping mall brand, mm-hmm. to be honest with you. Having said that, the stores in India are in shopping malls, and we and my partners over there collectively have done a really good job mm-hmm. of taking the sort of mild eccentricity of the brand and making it work in a kind of white box.
Okay. How are you finding your store? This is a very weird question for me. Your store sales compared to online sales?
Obviously, like most people in retail, online is outperforming bricks and mortar in sure. terms of growth. I've always had a slightly contrary view about retail, is that I've always believed in shops. And I think that the high street has got a promising future, but only the very best are going to survive, mm-hmm. and they will have to adapt and survive. And I think, interestingly, we're seeing a very rapid return to small, local, and relevant.
Okay,
it's the small, local, and relevant high streets and clusters of shops that are reinventing. They're nimbler, they're quicker than the big stores.
Sure.
And they're able to offer a really great experience, a point of difference, a reason to leave your computer. You're not going to leave your computer if you're going to get sullen, gum-chewing shop girl ignoring you.
That's true. And what I don't like shopping online, especially for fashion, because I like to go into the shop, try it on, see what it feels like, talk to the person who's there working, which is one of the reasons why you like working in the shop as well, because
exactly.
you can talk to the customer, and seeing how it feels on me. And then I walk out of the shop because yes. that's how I shop. I walk into one shop, find something I like. If I like it, I'm out, and that's it. I'm done with the shopping. However, when you are shopping online, you get the opportunity to just say, yeah, I like that, pick it, buy it. When it comes to you 2 days later, one day if you're Amazon Prime, you try it on, and it may not fit, or it may not, as you said, you like to feel comfortable in,
yes.
in what you're wearing.
Yes.
That's why I do prefer going to the shop.
Absolutely. And I think we will see a return to this. I mean, it's interesting that everyone in my sector is talking about maybe 2019 being the year of online growth plateauing
okay.
in fashion. The years of exponential growth have gone. The growth curve has been shallowing for a while.
Mm.
And I think that in an age where we are, of course, globally more connected than ever before in history,
yes.
we're also more disconnected than ever before in history.
That's
we
true.
We're more remote from our fellow man.
Yeah.
And we're animals, and we have a kind of pack instinct within us. But I come back to this. You're going to have to really step up your game, British retail. People will come into your store if you're going to give them a great experience, if they're going to go out smiling, if they're going to go out saying, that was great. That was better than being in front of my computer.
Ordering online while...
Online, you know, and that's the challenge. That's the challenge for us retailers, is to give that, whether in my stores it's about they're full of odd antiques and weird paintings, and I've got very charismatic managers who will engage you and give you the backstory on the product and make it very personal and very relevant, or whether it's mixing it up and having, you know, a nail bar and a coffee salon in a fashion shop, or whatever mm-hmm. it might be, or a kind of boutique cinema with an unused basement in a shop. It's got to be about making something different, making people talk, giving retail a little bit of a buzz. And the big retailers are going to really struggle with this because
okay.
they're like lumbering elephants.
Sure.
And they can't move quick enough.
They don't have the same thing that the way you're set up as well, where you could walk into a shop and you could personally assist the customer. Whereas one of the bigger, you talk about Ralph Lauren, for example, you wouldn't have the founder walking around in a Ralph Lauren shop, because that's more, they hire people to do that.
They do, but I think also with the very big groups, I mean, Ralph Lauren is probably not a bad example. It's a successful business, although it's had a little bit of trouble recently. But it's making those staff feel connected to Ralph personally
yeah.
so they can pass that connection on to the customer.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what this is about. It's about connection in a disconnected age. And Selfridges, for instance, do it very well for other reasons, because they created theatre and drama. Mm-hmm. And we have to remember that once upon a time, department stores were the only place you could see electric light.
Yes.
Escalators.
Yes, that's true.
Lifts. You know, they were absolutely innovative of their time.
Yeah.
And they gave you this sense of drama and theatre and excitement that you just couldn't find anywhere else. And I think Selfridges tap back into that extremely well.
Yeah.
Harrods have always done it in their own way. But I think what's smart about Selfridges and why they're doing so well and will undoubtedly stand the test of time is that they get the sense of theatre. Mm-hmm. And that's their way of giving experience.
I mean, I take this with a pinch of salt. I gathered my knowledge of Selfridges from the show Selfridges, which was Jeremy Piven. ITV did it a few years ago. What you're saying is absolutely correct. He wanted to bring a sense of theatre to the customers. So there would be a different display, and he always had a group of people who would work on a display for an entire week trying to set everything up. And it always kind of tied into some of the things that happened that was happening at the time.
Yes.
Just to basically bring people in, even though there was a war going on, they could come into a store and feel safe and feel entertained and feel happy.
Yes, exactly.
And I think that's still, I guess that's why, just as you said, you'd want your staff to feel as connected to Ralph Lauren.
Yes.
To be able to do that. Now, do you do that in your own stores?
Totally. What I do is I work very closely with my managers and really empower them to feel that the stores are their own.
Okay.
Up to a certain point, but they are their own stores. It's about really letting them have that. It's about letting them feel proud, letting them feel responsible, letting them feel that their customers are their customers. They're not customers of Simon Carter Limited. They are their own customers. And building that up. And it's not an easy thing to do. And I tend, as a rule, to employ slightly older staff because I think they come a little bit more from that culture.
Okay.
That's not exclusively throughout my business. It's cultural. It's got to come from the top. It's got to come from the top. You know, we come back to this. I think, in a way, the anecdote you gave about me being on the shop floor, getting up for an interview and going and serving that customer. And then when they found out they were being served by Simon Carter, they got super excited and posed for selfies. And that was an extra point of engagement for them. I think that goes to the core of the brand. I think it is a very personal brand.
Do you dress your own staff?
They have an allowance. Yep, they wear some.
Yeah, an allowance that can be spent in the store.
No, as in a free allowance. Thank you, Mark.
Okay.
You're making me out to be the unacceptable face of capitalism.
I was just asking. I had to confirm, right?
You did, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. No, they as in they can wear whatever they want from the collection.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. That's good. You're listening to Shoot the Breeze on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Marcus E. Acko, and in the studio with me is Simon Carter, who is the founder of Simon Carter Limited. You can find his website, Simon. SimonCarter.net, correct?
.net, yeah.
.net. But you can go into House of Fraser and see some of his material. You can go to London Mayfair, to Blackheath. You can go to Crystal Palace. You can find, Google Simon Carter, you'll find his store locations and see some wonderful shirts, cufflinks. And you moved into shoes now, you said?
Yes, that's right. So began doing shoes about a year ago, about 18 months ago. Yeah. And again, that was just about finding the right partner, really, and just feeling really comfortable and ready to do it. Yes. And
right.
I think that completes it, actually, on clothing. I've got caps. Yes.
You want to start doing berets?
Coats. We do some beautiful tweed flat caps, actually.
Nice.
Yorkshire milled. Very lovely. Very lovely.
Right.
I could see you in one, actually, Marcus.
Are you
a hat man?
I am a hat man, but and this is to my own detriment. I like the name escapes me. Trilby. Is it? Are they Trilby? Trilbies? Yeah, Trilbies.
Trilby. Yeah.
Yeah. I tend to like I wear them if I'm wearing a hat, but then I'm very forgetful. I will leave it on the tube or on the bus or whatever.
But you see, isn't it interesting? Yeah, we talk about the difference between fashion and style. I don't think of a trilby as particularly fashionable or unfashionable, but you've made it unknowingly, unconsciously, part of your personal style. See?
Okay, I see your point. I see your point. I'll make sure I find my next
and
one.
It could be
I'll,
something really small. I mean, it. People think this is a bit odd, but I always wear two watches. And
I didn't notice that. Oh, okay.
And I've always done since I was a teenager.
Is there a particular reason why? Or
at a time when friends were maybe getting an ear pierced or wearing a ring or other bits and pieces, I just didn't really go for that. And I've always liked watches.
So you wear two watches, one on each hand?
One on each hand, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk films.
Let's talk films.
I sent you a message before we started the show.
Mm-hmm.
Five films or television shows where the costumes blew your mind.
Mm.
What's your number five?
Well, number, they're in no particular order, I have to say. Don't ask me. I asked,
do
I have to rank them?
You have to rank
them. I have to rank them.
Absolutely. I always say this, that basically when the five that you mentioned here in that particular order stays locked
right,
in.
Okay.
So whatever the consequences happen.
Deal,
absolutely. Whatever the consequences happen afterwards when people attack you in the street, I will judge you. Yes, I will. Let me hear what they are first.
He's got his judgment face on. I'm quite scared. Okay.
You haven't seen my judgment face yet. Let's see what your number five is.
All right. So number five. I'm actually going to put this one at number five. And we talked off air about the fact that I wanted to limit the number of Kubrick films. I didn't want like a kind of Kubrick fest. But it's going to be 2001.
Okay. Space Odyssey.
Yeah. And one of the reasons that I like the costumes in that is we talked a little bit about this sort of interesting notion of crossing over points in film and fashion.
Yeah.
And Hardy Amis did a lot of the costumes for that.
Oh, I didn't know. Okay.
Yeah. And actually, not many people did. And he was pretty reticent about it afterwards. And it's only recently discovered a whole trove of papers in the basement about 4 or 5 years ago of all of his sketches for it.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't do all of it, but he did a big chunk of it. And I just love the fact that you've got this very kind of old school, very British, quite uptight tailor. He published a fantastic guide to etiquette. It's still in print, and it's absolutely coruscatingly pithy and funny and sarcastic and rude and snobbish. It's a terrific read. And there he is mixing it with Kubrick, who I imagine would have been very demanding, but produced some really great stuff as a result of it. And you can see the tailoring, actually, when you sort of revisit the film and look at it. Things like the Air Steward or Space Steward's uniforms. He did all of that. All the tweed suits in it, he did all of those.
Oh, okay. Oh, I did not know that. That's I'm going to put that note down and mention it when and put it in my list of costumed films and so I have that in my list. What's your number four?
Okay, so number four, I'm going to get the Kubricks out of the way, is Barry Lyndon.
You're going to keep listing his number five to one is Kubrick.
You did say it was okay to go all Kubrick. But
you can if you want to, but when we get to Clockwork Orange, we might then push it aside.
Exactly. No, it's Barry Lyndon. I remember seeing that some time ago, and of course it is a little bit of an overlooked Kubrick film. It's not perhaps his best known, perhaps not his most popular.
I think if you're ranking it with all the others, and we did kind of briefly talk about this, in my own opinion, is not as controversial as the other ones.
Agreed.
I mean, you have Clockwork Orange, which had the violence and the sexual scenes in that. You had you talked about Dr. Strangelove. With Dr. Strangelove, yes, that was politically driven. Satire was great. And then the more recent ones like Eyes Wide Shut, where you had Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman, that was kind of overshadowed. Yeah, there were the elements of sex in it, but it was more overshadowed by the fact that you had Tom Cruise and his wife in the movie.
Yes.
And so that's what brings those movies. And then you talk Shining and Full Metal Jacket, which are powerful in their own right. But then Barry Lyndon, it's sort of... it's underrated in that regard. It falls through the cracks. Ryan O'Neill, it falls through the cracks because it can't really compete against the weight of everything else.
Do you like it as a film?
I think it's all right. But in comparison to the other Stanley Kubrick movies, for me, it's not one of my favorites of his.
Which would be your favorite?
Favorite would be Full Metal Jacket. It's a tie between Full Metal Jacket. I'll take that completely back. Full Metal Jacket is my second favorite. Doctor Strangelove is my favorite. Doctor Strangelove is absolutely the Kubrick film I will go back and watch over and over again. But this isn't about me. This is about
you. Sorry, we got distracted.
Yeah.
Okay.
I saw what you were trying to do there, but you were talking about Barry Lyndon.
I was talking about Barry Lyndon. So what I like about Barry Lyndon, and the first time I saw it and why it stuck in my mind, is the sumptuousness of the costume, the kind of no expense sparedness of the costumes.
Sure.
There's almost a decadence about it. It's obviously a very period drama. It's based, at the end of the
18th century?
Yeah. Also, which I only realized later on, is that in a very pioneering way, Kubrick shot every interior scene just by candlelight.
I did not know that. Okay.
Very, very difficult to do. Very demanding. They had to come up with new techniques to do it. But you get that sort of softness about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to make the clothes glow in a way.
Yeah.
Have another look at some of the stills from it. And again, off air, we chatted a little bit and I mentioned that... I was extremely good friends with his daughter, who very sadly died about 10 years ago. And going out to the Kubrick house once, we were just pottering about and found in an outhouse box after box after box of partly burnt Barry Lyndon candles.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know why he'd box them all up and ship them back, but...
Yeah, they'd keep as a souvenir,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but it was just really amazing to sort of touch a little bit of film history there.
Yeah. Did you grab some?
No.
Why not? It's not like it was being used. It's
we just don't do that. Really.
It was in an outhouse. You could have just asked.
You would have done, wouldn't you? You'd have made a distraction. I would put some in your pocket.
Hey, I would have asked
you'd have
nicely.
Nicely.
I would have. I would have said something using?
I should have done, shouldn't I?
Yeah, you should have.
But then what do you do with it? Because you don't want to burn it.
No, you won't burn it. You just keep it in your house every time you.
But you know, I could show you some candles in my house that partly burned. Say, so you know what? I was joking. I did take some Barry Lyndon.
And I would believe you.
No,
that's true. I'd believe you. I'd be like, oh wow, that's good.
You got a Barry Lyndon candle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'd have a sense that it wasn't Barry Lyndon candles, though, but, you know, I don't know. You're listening to Shoot the Breeze on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Marcus E. Acko, and we're talking with Simon Carter, designer extraordinaire. He designed the costumes for the current run of Crystal Maze. He also is the founder and designer of Simon Carter Limited. You go get amazing shirts, cufflinks, and now shoes. But we're talking his top five favorite films/TV shows where the costumes blew his mind. You're now number three.
Number three, okay. And it's almost difficult to whittle down. Because I'm a film fan.
I'm waiting to see if you bring in the Hunger Games in there. But
no.
The Hunger Games is not in there?
The Hunger Games isn't in there.
All right, fair enough.
Well, you did ask me to sort of give this more of a costume slant.
Sure.
Because I was going to put in High Rise.
Oh, the, not Benedict, Tom
Hiddleston.
Tom Hiddleston, yes. Yeah. Okay.
I was going to, but that's a great film. But then I've got a, and I know it's controversial because most people hated it, but I loved it.
I didn't.
I think that's the architect buff in me as well, actually.
True. Okay. Now that makes sense. Because the reason why that threw me was because I didn't consider the costumes.
There aren't
in
really
there.
Any costumes to worry about in there, so that's why it's not on my list.
Oh, fair enough.
Okay. So I'm digressing. Okay.
No worries. Trust me, you sound like you've heard the show before. That's all we do on the show. We digress. Yes.
Okay. So coming back, yeah, because that scene on the roof with Jeremy Irons and the White Horse, just trippy. I don't know whether J.G. Ballard had that originally in the novel. I'd have to go back and reread it. Anyway, moving on. Gattaca.
Oh, okay. You mentioned that earlier.
Yeah.
Ethan Hawke, Jude Law.
Yeah, Gattaca. Yeah. You know, it seems to be a little bit of a theme looking at this.
It's sci-fi,
it's
right?
Sort of, yeah, sci-fi, but that sort of intriguing, futuristic meets retro, because you couldn't really necessarily tell from the costumes. They're beautifully tailored. I don't actually know who costume designer was on that one. Also, it does tie into my love of old cars because, weirdly, they drive around in a 1970s Rover P6, which is a bit random as well.
It is a great way to sort of balance out, we talked about this a few minutes ago, balance out futuristic, well, especially sci-fi. Sci-fi tends to do that quite a lot, where you set a lot of the action, a lot of technology in future, but you ground it or you bring about, you mention retro.
Yeah.
For me, a good example of something that does that, and it's throwing it a little bit, The Incredibles. I don't know if you've watched The Incredibles.
Yes. Yeah.
It's set in a futuristic world where you have superheroes. However, everything is pretty much, it looks like it's 1950s Americana. You had the cars, you had the outfits, you had the houses, all felt like the 50s.
Yes.
However, it's set in the future.
Yeah, like the Batman franchises, I suppose.
Yeah, that too, exactly.
Yeah,
which actually
would have been a good one to put in.
Maybe number one. So Gattaca's your number three.
For that reason, and there's this slightly sort of beige quality to it.
Yeah.
If you look at the tailoring, it's really good.
Okay.
Jude Law, absolutely on point. So I need to find out who the costume designer was on that one. I'm sure one of the listeners can tell us. So next up on my list, okay, bear with me here.
Okay.
I'm going a little bit.
No judgy face.
Okay, he's got a very neutral face on. Is Goodfellas.
Nice. And you move through the eras with that one as well.
Yeah.
So you go from, okay.
Yep. Those collars on those shirts in that scene, in that bar.
Yes.
I don't even watch the action. I'm just watching the collars. It was Armani having a blast.
Okay.
Peak of his power. The absolute only go-to at that time for serious costume and serious big movies.
All right. Now, again, Scorsese's movies I watch for dialogue, acting, music especially. I really need to start focusing on the costumes. I'm going to go back and watch that movie and check out. I know the scene you're talking about. It's where Ray Liotta's character, Ray Liotta, what's his name? Where they attack the.
That's right.
I won't give it away, but it starts the movie, but you come back to it afterwards.
Funny guy.
That's the one. Yeah. Oh, that's the boss thing you're talking about. Okay, fair enough. Okay.
Yeah. And there's just something, it's weird because he's caught that kind of decadent, drug dealing, mafiosa feel with the clothing.
Yeah.
And there's also, I don't know why, but even if you saw those characters and didn't know them out of context, or didn't know them in context, you saw them in those suits, you know they're trouble.
Sure.
You just know these people are trouble. Despite the fact that it's beautiful, impeccable tailoring. Something really menacing about the costume.
About the men's suits, yes.
The men's suits, the collars. Yeah. Scary collars.
That's a good pull. I never would have pulled Goodfellas into a list for costumes. That's your number two.
And if you read anything about Armani being interviewed around it, he's really proud of that one. I think he really enjoyed that. Yeah.
They were good suits, absolutely. Okay. You're listening to Shoot the Breeze on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Marcus E. Acco. Simon Carter is about to tell us his number one favorite costume or favorite film, TV show where the costumes blew his mind.
Do we have a drum roll?
I can do one.
Okay. So it's TV. We're onto TV here. Okay. And it is The Persuaders.
Roger Moore, yes. Tony Curtis, yes. I loved that show.
Yes.
That basically was, it wasn't the Saint, it was that show that made, that gave him the role of James Bond.
Absolutely.
I loved that show, and I can see why.
Well,
was it the turtlenecks?
No, it's not the turtlenecks, because here's another little known fact. Roger Moore designed nearly all his own outfits for that.
Really?
For that series, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
He worked with Doug Hayward on Mount Street, and basically, Moore sketched out all the outfits.
Huh.
Everything from the Norfolk jackets to the safari jackets. Yeah.
I did not know Roger Moore had an eye for fashion.
Yeah.
I mean, as in terms of designing.
Interesting, actually. I think we'd have to say an eye for style there.
You're right.
Not even then. I don't think any of that stuff was particularly in fashion. It was just very particular.
Hence the difference between style and fashion. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So beautifully tailored again. Doug Hayward was the principal tailor on that. But Moore designed not all, but most of his own costumes for that series. For me, it just absolutely sums up the 70s. It just shrieks 70s, the whole thing. Also, as a car fan, it's got
That's true.
Aston Martin DBS and a Ferrari Dino.
That's true.
246 Dino.
See, now that one is definitely a TV show that as soon as you said Persuaders, I knew exactly what you were talking about. It was the fashion was very memorable. It sticks with you. It's part of what made that show really, really good. Obviously, the chemistry between Roger Moore and Tony Curtis.
That really helps.
Yeah, definitely.
That was kind of a real sort of bromance series. I think also what is sort of interesting from a fashion perspective is that if you look at a lot of, particularly Roger Moore's outfits, or there's some of Tony Curtis's as well, by anybody's standards, they're pretty high camp.
Especially the turtlenecks that Tony Curtis was running around with.
Yeah, these big old turtlenecks. But I like that. There's a kind of masculine blousiness about a lot of what they were wearing, which I think is really endearing. Right. And
wouldn't you just lump that in with 70s style?
Yes, but you would. I agree, and that was absolutely out there in the 70s. I think for me, what the Persuaders did is they sort of took it to a new extreme, and I think they must have had very indulgent producers.
Yeah.
Or maybe Roger Moore said, I'm not appearing in this unless you let me do this.
He had that much of a pull to do that.
I guess he did, yeah. So that's my number one.
Excellent. That's The Persuaders. And for those of you who haven't seen it, find out where you can find those shows and watch it. They went for a very limited run, I think maybe two seasons at most, but a great show. Go and check it out. You're listening to Shoot the Breeze on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Marcus E. Acco. Simon, thank you very much for coming to the studio with us. Where can people reach you if they need to get a hold of you or at least get a hold of your designs?
Well, like we say, online is probably best, simoncarter.net. Everything's up there. We offer a really super speedy service. Or if you're in central London, just pop into my Mayfair showroom.
Are you always there?
I'm not always there. Yeah. There might be some looky-likies, but
Is that right? Yeah. So you hire people to look like you.
You can get a hold of me on Twitter. Just contact me through Twitter.
You did mention Twitter, which was at the King of Cuffs.
King of Cufflinks. Yeah.
Okay. King of Cufflinks.
King of Cufflinks.
Excellent. And I'm gonna hold on to these two cufflinks, these two pairs of cufflinks that you've left, and they'll just go missing.
Actually a gift for you.
Oh, are they?
Yeah,
oh, thank you. I was kidding, but thank you. I'm definitely gonna take them.
Listen, they're a little gift because I know secretly. You're going to wear the frogs.
You know what? I will wear the frogs. I'll keep the cubes for professional situations. So, maybe not. In fact, no. Let's reverse that. I will wear
the frogs to a wedding.
Really, really, you should wear the frogs to a wedding because it's a little conversation point. People will see them, and it just provides a little icebreaker for people you don't know.
Okay. That's what I'm going to be doing. The frogs ones are mine, but I will keep that just the just block case. Ones just in case.
Good.
Thank you very much for coming
My
in.
My pleasure.
You can listen to this show. Our podcast comes out every Monday, Monday around midnight. Look for Shoot the Breeze on Resonance 104.4 FM or Shoot the Breeze with Marcus Iacco and Laura Sampson. This will air on Friday at 7 p.m. as we normally do on Radio on Resonance 104.4 FM. But thank you very much for listening. Speak to you next week.
I'm Pat Fraley, and those were a few of the characters I carry around in my hip pocket.
This is the radio station you need to be listening to, lad.
Between exercises, I'll slip in critical information.
104.4 FM, radio station, Resonance FM.
And other feats of insanity and joy.
Inspector Gadget.